Blog Talk Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, my name is Billy Blade. This is the biggest little show on radio. We also run Vendetta Pro Radio on Tuesday nights. Our guest tonight is a former WWE, ECW legend. This is a.k.a. Simon Dean, a.k.a. Hollywood Nova, a.k.a. Supernova. How are you doing, Nova, today? Or tonight, I guess you say.
I'm doing good, man. I always forget how many names that I had. Until I do a couple things like this, and I'm like, yeah, I've been around for a minute. So.
You've been around for a long time, I know that much. According to maybe everybody on these shows, they always ask, hey, how'd you get started, this and that. I mean, I try to research because I've known you for a long time, but like, maybe if someone doesn't actually know you, is there a way you can actually give us a rundown of where you started, who you trained you?
Yeah, for sure.
You know, whatnot.
And it's funny that you asked that because I just found the other day, I've been talking to guys about releasing some of this stuff too. I found a bunch of footage from my original school that I went to. So basically in late 1992, 28 years ago, go figure. In New Jersey, born and raised in New Jersey, there was a real respected veteran wrestler there named Iron Mike Sharp. Look him up, gang, if you don't know who he is. But Iron Mike Sharp had a school in New Jersey. So I went to that. I graduated from high school, was going to college. I had a full-time job. And I started going to Mike's school on the side. And kind of got my feet wet there a little bit. Made some lifelong friends there. My brother went there. He became a manager eventually. A bunch of other guys went to the school. Notables from that time period in the early 90s, mid-90s, were Ace Darling, Devin Storm, The Wall. Chris Candido used to come by. So we had a lot of stuff going on in the Northeast, but I was just a fan my whole life. Always watched wrestling on TV. Never thought of it ever doing it serious. I had a friend of mine, Rich, who went to Mike Sharp's school training, and I used to go and watch him, me and my brother. And then eventually they just asked me if I wanted to try it, and I said, yeah. And I don't necessarily know if I was hooked, because right away I just figured I would just do – because Mike had shows at the school every other week. So we would do the shows there, and they were fun. All of us got to hang out, and this is like 93 at that point. But on top of that, Billy, you might not remember, maybe you do, but back in the early 90s, when they had the shows for WWE on TV, they would always have the enhancement matches on Saturday mornings and stuff like that. And whenever they came to the Northeast, Mike would bring – because that was Mike's calling card. He was – I hate using the word jobber, but he was an enhancement guy for years. So whenever the WWE would come around in the early 90s, they would need guys to do those matches. So that was my first taste of, after about a year in the school, doing the enhancement matches in WWE and stuff like that. And from there,
yeah,
it just kind of
rolled.
Yeah,
I have that in my notes, actually. So. Yeah. Actually, I have those in my notes because, like, it said you were working WWF matches in 93 against guys like Steiners and stuff like that, if I recall.
The Headbanger, the Head Shrinkers, Adam Bomb. All those guys.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
How it was, Billy. Like, you – when did you start? I forget. Late mid-90s,
yeah,
early – night. When?
Yeah, I started in 99. So it started getting kind of like when you were around – you know, when you first started, that's how you got your experience, correct? I mean, that's – you
100%.
Didn't go and do –
that's
you didn't – exactly. So
– you hit it on the head. That's different today. I mean
– sure is.
There's no way in the world today – when I don't do shows anymore, I very rarely go to them. I talk to some of the guys here and there, but back then you did a ton of independence. You tried to latch on somewhere. You went up and did TVs. You did your enhancement matches. I mean, hell, you go back and look. You saw everybody from Scotty Too Hotty Taylor and the Hardy Boys and the Headbangers, and there's so many guys that started as job guys, but you had to break in somewhere. So now it's different. Like, I think a guy will go to a wrestling school, and in a month, he already has a gimmick picked out and a theme song. He wants a push. He wants to do this. He wants to do that. And it's just so different than it was. My God, I can't believe I'm going to say this, but almost 30 years ago, it's a completely different industry, one that I don't necessarily recognize, but it's not my industry anymore. It belongs to the people who are calling the shots today, and they run it. So it's their thing, not mine.
Totally. Well, you know what's funny is, okay, so when I started in 99, my trainer is Jesse Hernandez and Bill Anderson.
Oh, I love
the original school
yeah.
I went to. Well, then my actual in-ring, I would say, trainer, who was basically at every training, because Jesse wasn't in the ring as much, was that
Slammers then?
Partner,
Slammers
right?
Gym? Is that what Jesse's school was called?
No,
Slammers, right?
No, he had the School of Hard Knocks. And
School
Slammers
of Hard Knocks, that's right. Yep, sorry, Jesse.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, no, it's right. And see, back then, with Jesse's school and all, there was only like a handful of schools, all pro wrestling. Jesse Hernandez, School of Hard Knocks, and then, of course, Slammers is, I think, around the same time as Jesse's, and maybe one or two more. But like you were saying, I mean, it's crazy to think how it is now, because back then I had a lot of guys that trained with me and whatnot, including the guy that kind of helped. Was basically the head trainer at my class was your partner, Frankie Gazarian. And the crazy thing is then I went on to Ultimate Pro Wrestling and started training there after Jesse's. But, I got a guy, one of my friends, his debut match that he trained with Jesse was against Vader at a WWE show, you know, or WWF house show.
Yeah.
That's just how it was back then. And now, like you said, I funny thing is we have a school out here in California. Called a Kayfabe College. It's ran by the Ballard brothers. They don't have their gym open because they had to move out of the building in LA, but I have mine open in Santa Maria. But of course we ain't doing anything right now, of course, but crazy story. I had a student recently, you'll love this one, who basically been training for a couple months and messaged me after I announced my show in February and told me that he wants to let me know he's ready to be on the show, and he has a blank check to let me know. And he has a gimmick. He wants to pick out his opponent. He also wants to win the match in a certain way. I was like, brother, you know,
he doesn't understand. And I mean this as a near 30-year veteran guy, I guess, and a 47-year-old man. I am letting that young man know, the one that called you, I'm letting him know that if that conversation that took place with you and him taken place a decade earlier, the way it would have went was you would have told that kid who called you, sure, man, no problem. I'll put you in a great match tonight against so-and-so. And then you would have found one of the rougher assholes on your roster. Sorry for the language. You would have smartened that guy up. You wouldn't have smartened up the kid who called you. The kid who called you would have went in the ring. He would have got his teeth knocked in. He would have got beat up and stretched and really hurt. And the guy doing it to him would have done it because you asked him to it, but he would have been insulted by it. That's exactly what would have happened to that young man. And I'm not saying that's good or bad. It's just that's the nature of what that beast was back then. Today,
those conversations happen
all the time. I mean,
that's called ticket sellers. Oh, totally. And I'm with you. And the thing is like, he didn't call me, by the way, bro. He was one of my students and been training for 4 months, but four months, like maybe once a week. And then, once to twice a month in a 4 month period, and lets me know. I'll know when you're ready. Trust me, you know? And then he wanted to let me know that he's ready. And I have a blank check to let you, you know, to get my opponent and to basically you put whatever amount you want to make sure I debut at that show. I said, that's not how I was trained.
That?
And
I mean,
and you know,
you have an idea. You know how this works. The Ballard brothers, anybody who goes to that school knows how it works. But here's the problem. This is just from, you know, I don't want to say salty older guy, but this is what has happened, Billy, over the last generation of guys. The large majority of what has occurred, there were way too many guys that wanted to get into pro wrestling because they all wanted to be stars. First off, if the majority of people knew what it took to be a star outside of the ring and all the stuff that goes with that, they would never want to be a star again because they could never pull it off. But what happened was there were so many people wanting to get into wrestling, like your guy. They went in for a month, yep. 2 months, 4 months, whatever it was. Then all of a sudden they got out. They were running shows. They were wrestling on shows. They were main events. They were winning belts. Every person on the goddamn planet as a show now has a belt. But yeah. All these guys, and then they started opening up wrestling schools. That they started going around the all this stuff. My idea for a reality show a couple years back, and I tried to pitch this. I didn't get any traction because I didn't put enough time into it. I wanted to go around wrestling schools around the country like Gordon Ramsay does with Kitchen Nightmares and try to turn them around or shut them down.
Oh, my God.
Be brutally honest with the people because I never understood. My number one thing that I would ask people – and I don't care if you didn't draw millions of dollars, it doesn't necessarily make you a bad trainer. But you have to take into consideration who's running the school, who's training it, and what the hell have they done in the business. And the guy, yeah. I would always ask these guys, and they would talk about, even today, oh, I'm going to so-and-so's school, or who trained me, or whatever it was. The first question I always ask any talent when I meet them, I talk to them, who broke you in? And if they say a name, like, oh, yeah, I was trained by a Cowboy Jenkins, Leroy Jenkins or whatever, and I'll say, who is that? And most of the time, they look at me like I'm nuts for not knowing who that is. And I'm like, well, I've only followed the industry pretty closely for the last 30 years, but I guess it was a guy who was pretty popular I missed. But that's what happened. Too many guys became decision makers, became this, they own a show, they own a promotion, they did all this stuff, and it got so watered down that everybody has it. Could you imagine wanting to become a professional doctor or a lawyer or a surgeon or a dentist or anything like that, and somebody goes to that guy to dentist college to learn how to do it. They drop out. And then all of a sudden, a month later, like, hey, you don't have to go there, man. I'm going to teach you how to pull teeth. I'm going to teach you how to do anesthesia. I'm going to teach you – because I went there for a little while. Like, that, you can't get into baseball – or the NFL, or the NHL, the NBA, by going to, like, an NBA camp for a month or something and then leaving, and then all of a sudden be playing a Madison Square Garden against the Lakers. Like, I never understood why wrestling devalued itself so much at that ground level and just decided to let in every single piece of shit in humanity who wants to become a pro wrestler.
Oh, and you know what? And that's totally like – so when I was training, like I said, I trained at a school, like a replical school. And then what ended up happening with me personally is I end up having a newborn. So I actually trained maybe a year and a half, 2 years, something like that. I actually opened my own thing just to kind of have somewhere to pacey practice, you know, because I didn't get the training as much. So I'm kind of guilty of that. But the thing is I brought a lot of people in – to help me with it, you know what I mean? Which helps me.
Yeah, you got a good
like
head on your
Ballard
shoulders,
brothers.
Though, so that's different.
Yeah, like
yeah, it's,
yeah.
That's different.
Well,
you're
and the
smart,
Ballard brothers,
so.
And you know the Gangrels. When I teamed up with Gangrel almost 15 years on and off. So, you know, so
yeah,
that's
you
that
know.
Was huge, you know, for
you're
me.
Smart
so,
though.
Yeah, exactly.
You're a normal, intelligent human being. For whatever reason, and you, God, you see this more than I do. But for whatever reason, professional wrestling seems to attract not only some of the lowest caliber athletes in the world who want to become wrestlers all of a sudden. You have to, when you want to become a successful professional wrestler, you have to be the best athlete, entertainer, self-promoter, like all of this businessman, businesswoman, all combined. And wrestling just, I mean, ever since the day I got in it, we always say there was a phrase amongst all the boys, only in wrestling, man, or you'd only see this in wrestling. But it just seems to attract is such a lesser caliber of so many guys that just effing assume that one day they just rolled out of bed and because they played WWE 2K or whatever, that all of a sudden they can become a wrestler. It's so insulting and it's such bullshit to the people who really worked hard and tried to make a success of themselves in the industry. There's so much junk that mired it down, that Billy, you and I both know this, for the large majority, if you go to most people, and if you look like a normal guy, like me and you walking down the street, we look like normal guys. We were never muscle heads or jacked or crazy, but we look like normal guys. If you go to most human beings on Earth and have an intelligent conversation with them and somehow happen to tell them that you're a professional wrestler, you're involved in the industry, the image that they're painting in their head of a pro wrestler is not complimentary. Like, they're not instantly thinking, like, oh, he's like
at all.
Or he's, they're thinking of a garbage junk guy who's jumping around or just something crazy because they've seen that silliness on the internet and it's been destroyed from within.
Totally. I was just going to say, like, me and you, we had the long hair back in the day. I knew that we kind of like, you're right. I mean, you see the guy, I mean, I don't know who the guy personally is. If he's making money doing it, I guess it is, but I've seen some guy, some kid on the internet who's like millions of views by throwing himself on like his name's Superhuman or something like that. He's throwing himself on trash cans and he just jumps off his porch into a microwave and stuff like that. I'm like, what the hell is going on here? You know?
It's not wrestling.
And he's
getting
booked.
I don't know what that is, but it's not
booked.
Wrestling.
I know. And he's getting booked in indie shows. I'm like, oh my God, that's what's wrong with wrestling these days.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, and it, back in the day, they weren't allowed to be at our show. Even, go backstage, they'd have to buy a ticket. You know,
we've allowed it. They've allowed,
yeah,
it.
Allowed it.
The promoter, because
yeah, exactly.
The promoter said to themselves, look, here's what the promoter said. You know what, man, I got my wrestling show. So instead of creating good characters who have an issue of good versus bad, jockeying for position to try to win, move up the rankings, where the good guy gets his heat back on the bad guy, they contest for a title, like any of that soap opera type angles to run, they just decide to do a crash bang, bring in a stunt show guy or some bullshit hokey thing to throw out there to pop the house or try to, and then it doesn't work long term. And then, but the expectations, Billy, of most promoters are, listen to me, I'm dead serious when I say this. Listen, people out there who listen to this right now, I'm right about this. Billy, the goal of most promoters who are running professional wrestling shows is not to make money. I swear to God, it's so they can run a show, so they can tell everybody they're a promoter, so they can book a bunch of their friends or people who hang out with or have fun with, so they can put it on tape, and they can all drink afterwards and watch the show, and then it can all tell their buddies, man, I had a match, or I did this, or I did that. I'm telling you, it has to be. Because when you watch these shows and watch 20 people sitting in the
crowd. 100%.
100%. It's not. The goal of most of these promoters around the country who are running wrestling shows in front of 10 people, 15, whatever it is, their goal is not to make money. It's to have a wrestling show because that's their way of being in the business. So they can tell people, I'm a wrestling promoter. I run shows. Oh, yeah, I wrestled for Jim Tankins at the WXO show, and I'm his hardcore champion. Or, like, whatever bullshit nonsense it is. But there's very few wrestling promoters. For every Mike O'Brien who's been promoting Northeast Wrestling for 20 years and has been profitable in every show he has, there's 20 other – Billy Blade who's still running shows. I mean, these small amount of independent promoters who are actually making money off crowds, there's 20 or 30 other ones for each one of those guys who lose money on shows.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the truth.
I'll give you you know what? You hit the nail on the head. I mean, it's and unfortunately, it devalues what we had, the promoters that are actually been doing it a long time, like myself and other promoters out there, like you were saying. It devalues the product because, I mean, I'll give you a real quick example. I got a rival company that's around my area, and they started up because one of the wrestlers that wrestled for me got really drunk in a show and ended up doing something stupid and basically quit and then started his own company. Of course, that's how that works, right?
Of course,
yeah. And then so they obviously never made any money on their shows. Of course not, because they didn't know how to run a show. But fine, let's fast forward. This past year, they ran a show. And they bragged so well because they had 500 people. Great. That's a great turnout. But you as a booker, because we'll get to all that right now. This is a great conversation we're all having. So, because, you know, quite frankly, people need to hear it. And so, like, you as a booker, let's go for it. They had Ultimo Dragon. They had Psychosis, Bestia, and Damien 666. They had Hornswoggle. They had Mil Muertes. They had Tatarina. I think about two more people for sure, all names, half in flights. You know how it works. You know, the bottom line is
yep.
it was about a $15,000, $20,000 budget, and they drew about 500 people. Me and you both know that was a huge loss. But to them, that's a success. Well, me and you know that's not a success, and that's not how
he
you run a company.
He could have drawn the same 500 people with one or two of those names and used all
yep.
local guys.
What do we know, right?
No, I guess nothing. I mean, here's the thing, Billy. I'll say this. I've said this till the cows come home. There's people ask me all the time, man. Hey, how come you never became a trainer or a coach or opened up a school? I mean, I have one of the better resumes of the last 30 years. I mean, I've wrestled around the world, been in the ring with every major talent over the last 20 years, done every single job you can ever do in professional wrestling, from literally building rings to running developmental system for WWE and everything in between. I could never do it because I would lose my mind and I would go to jail for murder because I'd kill somebody. Because I couldn't stand I don't have the tolerance or the patience to just see one screw up after another destroying something that I gave a part of my life for a long time. I'm at peace with it. I love my life now. And I just couldn't imagine surviving month to month, week to week, year to year, whatever it was, like living in that world with just one goofball after another and just one dreg of society. I mean, there are some ray of lights. Don't get me wrong. There's some people that are really trying to do it right. And I talk to a lot of those guys. I mentor a bunch of them. I help them out. I talk to a ton of them. But there's just so many that ruin it for everybody else. And it just – I had no tolerance for any of that. I would just go nuts. So that's why I don't do anything in the industry anymore.
Well, you know what? And when I teach people these days, man, I still teach the respect of the business. I still teach them, and I don't even know if they teach people this anymore. I still teach them how to wipe their feet before they go in the ring, shake everybody's hand from the top to the bottom. And the thing about it, and humbleness, I would rather have a show full of, wrestlers that maybe aren't the greatest wrestlers in the world, but they are completely humble and want to be there than all these wrestlers that think they're the best.
Yep.
And loyal, exactly. And that's just the way I've always been taught. And I don't, maybe it's not the best policy but anymore, but I know when I was taught back in the day, that's how you had to do it, And, I do remember, what's funny is my very first show I ran, I drew 600 people. It was in March 2002. And the main event of that show was Nova versus S.A. Rios in the main event.
Oh, really?
You remember that match?
I remember the match. I remember, wasn't it supposed to be against somebody else and S.A. Rios came at the last minute?
Yeah, so it was.
Am I imagining that?
You and Super Crazy. Yeah, it was you and Super
That's
Crazy.
That's what it was, yeah.
1-on-1. Yeah, and the funny thing is our first major show. I mean, we ran gym shows for like a year, but that was our first show. We had like 500-600 people, somewhere around there. And I remember the bottom rope broke. It was the funniest thing I ever did. Your bottom rope broke, or the middle rope, and we switched the ropes. So there was no bottom rope. I just remember, I think S.A. Rios put you in a submission. You were trying to reach for the rope, but there was no rope. I just remember that kind of spot. It was pretty hilarious, So,
and we still made it work, man. And then, I'm the same guy now I was back then. I just never – I don't know, man. It's just weird. Like, it's so funny to look back and think of the journey. I think a lot of guys today, they're in such a – like you just mentioned something from almost 20 years ago. And that's part of the journey. And I think so many guys today, they start and within a matter of months, they just want to be major stars and all this and that. They just forget. They want to get to the destination, but they don't want to do the journey. They want to put in the time, and and there's so many wrestlers today just waste their time and they waste their bumps on stupid stuff that's never, ever going to get them any further or get them to where they want to be. So many wrestlers would be better off instead of going to wrestling some shitty shows that they're not going to get better on, wrestling in a terrible ring against someone who can hurt them, they would be better off spending extra time in the gym that weekend, getting a better diet, getting some better gear, and just being more selective with their shows and doing shows against good opponents and good rings and trying to – that way. I mean, I've never been a believer in, I just want to wrestle, man. I just want to go wrestle. I just love it so much. I want to go wrestle. I always hated that because, like, well, what are you getting out of it? Like, you're not going to make any money, really. As an independent, I don't want to burst anybody's bubble. As an indie guy, if you don't have any name value at all, if I'm booking a show, I'm probably going to give you 20 to 30 bucks for the night and say, here you go. Because that's what I was given when I first started. Here's a little history lesson for you. Watch this. So 1992, 1993, right? This is the Northeast wrestling scene. This is what you had. The Godfather, Dennis Carluzzo, ran New Jersey. Also in New Jersey, a guy named Mike Dano ran North Jersey. Staten Island was ran by Tommy D. Pennsylvania was ran by Dino Santa. Up in the Connecticut area and Boston area, it was a Boston bad boy. Sparta ran some shows up there. Gino Caruso ran shows in New Jersey. Mike Sharp had South Jersey a little bit. I mean, that's just eight or nine promoters right there who all had pretty decent shows. So we would all start working on these shows, myself, Donnie B., Rick Ratchett, Ace Darling, Devin, and we would put the word in for each other. So before you knew it, we'd have a – I mean, we were wrestling for Dino Santa every single week in Pennsylvania. So we would have a car full of guys going up to do the Dino shows, and we might get 20, 25 bucks a piece and some trans, and we were happy about it. We were trying to have decent matches, and the guy, and he took care of us. But today – these guys want to go do independent shows, and either they want $200 or $300, and they never drew a dime in their life, or they don't make shit, and they have a terrible match, they get hurt from it, and they don't. It doesn't accomplish anything.
And that's what I. You know what's funny is when I teach my guys, man, I teach them all this kind of stuff. Like I said, I'm not guaranteeing you anything. I'm just guaranteeing you're going to learn the basics. You're going to know how to wrestle. You're going to basically get taught how I was taught, which is basically less is more. That's what I was always taught. And the funny thing is I told you, I was telling what you were saying right now was exactly what I tell my students. I tell them, man, I tell you, there's companies I've wrestled for that were basically flash in the pan companies. And I basically wish I'd never really wrestled those companies because my bump card got a lot fuller than I expected because I had to do those shows because I had the mentality, I just want to wrestle everywhere. Now I regret that because just like yourself, I mean, I'm low on the totem pole when it comes to shows but yourself wrestling 200 days a year, whatnot. I mean, I try to teach that as much as I can. And so do the Ballards. And so there's a lot of guys I actually have on the radio shows because it's funny. I just started these radio shows recently. I had them years ago, but I brought them back and I wanted to basically, and so far every person I've had on our show, they've preached the same thing. And it's funny because it still works to this day. If you go out and run wrestle on a show, I still can go out there and wrestle on a show, and I know you can as well, and still probably be one of the better matches on the show because we are telling a story. We know how to tell it.
I don't do a whole lot of indies anymore, Billy, but the ones that I have over the last year or two, every single one of them, I can say this, and it's not a braggadocious statement, 100% I was the best thing on the show. And I, at the time, a 44, 45, 46-year-old man who's 20 pounds heavier, 30 pounds heavier than he was wrestling in his prime, I wasn't taking a ton of bumps. I physically couldn't do half of what I used to do just from a lifetime of, nagging injuries and just not doing it a whole lot anymore. But hands down, my act, as I call it, as Simon Dean out there, was the most memorable thing on the show and the most enjoyable, the most entertaining, and the most realistic. And it was also just walking. I mean, 90% of the locker rooms that I walked into, I would stand in the middle of the ring, and I stand in the middle of the locker room. And don't get me wrong, a lot of the guys are nice. They're nice guys. They're cool.
Yeah.
Some of them are trying hard. Some of them are just doing the old, let me put the cigarette out, brother. I'm a 25-year veteran, man. That whole act, which always astounded me. But most of these locker rooms, I would have – the only way on earth when I walked into most of these locker rooms, the only way that I was going to see any other stars in that locker room that night was going to be if somebody punched me in the face so I can get dizzy and see some stars. That's the only way it was going to happen. The level of expectation from the wrestlers themselves was so low that they were just – They were acting like they were at WrestleMania. And I'm the one looking around guys, there's 100 people outside. Like, let's try to get 120 or let's get 150. Let's go out there and do the best we can. Most of them don't ask for advice. Most of them don't really I guess, I don't know, man. It used to really rub me the wrong way years and years ago, but then I just was like, I don't care. I'm only here for the night. I'm here, not even the night. I'm here for a couple hours. Most of the shows I would go do, I would literally get there an hour before the show starts, let the guys sell their gimmicks and stuff, kind of hang out, and then as soon as the show's over, get my car and go. So,
well, especially nowadays, I mean, like you said, I mean, they just, there's a lot of egos. I mean, there's a lot more egos than used to be. I mean, like you said, because the egos would have been checked a long time ago. You know, nowadays.
Yeah,
you know,
I don't know what,
and,
I don't know why.
And I get called a lot on the internet and stuff, you know, Mark Starr and stuff. I'm the bitter vet because of all this. I'm not bitter. I'm just trying to show these. I'm hoping one of these shows every once in a while, maybe someone listening will go, you know what? They were right. Because, you know, I did the same thing everybody else did in the beginning. Like you said, I wrestled everywhere, bumped everywhere, did everything. But, man, like I said, man, by five to eight years in, you know, when I started teaming up with Gangrel, that's when I started learning. I was like, man, this is – wow, why was I doing it the other way? But
it's not, about the bumps.
You know,
it's exactly. Not just about the bumps. It's about the mentality, the professionalism, the approach to it, the training outside the ring, how you conduct yourself in the locker room with the other guys. Just like, are you watching I watched the entire show. Here's a little secret. I'll give you this one, too, for free. So when I would do the independent shows, I usually go on – I hate going on last. But they would put me on like 7th or 8th, and it's always to put over their local champion or something stupid. And I was like, I don't care, whatever you guys want to do. But I would always watch the whole rest of the show. And I would try to see what finishes got used on that show that the people somewhat reacted to, so I could use those finishes as false finishes in the main event. Because if the people got hooked once and they saw that, like a cradle or a roll-up or something, if they saw that beat somebody earlier on the show, if I'm using it later on in the match and they already saw somebody win with that, they might think it's going to work in my match too. So, but I'm only one of the only, it makes great sense. I mean, but I'm one of the only guys, every single independent show I ever do, I watch literally 90% of the card. And I'm usually one of the only ones who watches the card. And it's always just baffled me that I'm at the curtain watching this and not one other person is standing there watching the show.
That's crazy. Like, I mean, you can learn so much. I mean, especially nowadays, like you said, everybody does so many of everybody does a lot of each other's moves, you know, without even noticing it. You're turning it in. Exactly. You're turning it into an angle. I mean, you're turning it into a false finish, which is awesome because you're basically telling the story from all the matches earlier, which a lot of people can't even do that kind of wrestler. You know, they can't.
And I'm also watching to see what is the crowd reacting to. You know, every area is different. Every crowd is different. So what have they seen so far for the night? If the two matches right before me had a bunch of chain wrestling in the beginning and some face-off spots and stuff like that, then when I go out there, I'm going to take one tackle and roll out the ring and spend a minute before I get back in. They're like, hold on a minute, man. Let's slow this down and just do a bunch of pantomime or like whatever it may be. So I'm also watching to see what do the people buy? Because, you know, odds are I haven't been to that area before. And if I have, it hasn't been for years. And I'm not going to come back there anytime soon. So I don't know, especially if they run monthly. I don't know what the tendencies are there. So I'll ask some of the local guys there too, hey, you know, What do they bite around here? What are they into? Oh, man, they just do anything, man. Okay, cool, dude. Thanks. In other words, you have no idea what the hell I'm talking about. But it's just mind-boggling to me how difficult so many people have made this job and how so many people will continually tell you how much they want it and how much they sacrifice, brother, and I really want this, brother, and, oh, man, this is all I ever wanted to do, brother. But the only time they ever want this brother is when they get to the wrestling show and they get to play wrestler for a couple hours. But the other 123 hours for the week, they don't do anything to get better for when they're at the show. Nothing.
Yeah. No, totally. Yep. And you know what? I wanted you on the show because I've known you for a long time. A lot of people, my very first time seeing you actually wrestle live was at ECW Heatwave 2000 in LA. I think you guys wrestled the Baldies. I think, that's the first time I actually seen you.
Is that the one where we beat up XPW in the parking lot?
Yes. I wanted to talk
about
that.
Yeah, I remember that.
Because actually a lot of people don't know that real story. I've heard, you know, Balls Mahoney's on our show a few times, and on our actual wrestling shows and whatnot, and a few other people. Then I've heard multiple stories. We have a little time to get that story real quick. I do want to say something. Well, you know what? Let's go to that story if that's okay. What was the story of that? Because
yeah.
I want to get to another story, but I know that's going to take some time once we get to this story. So, or the next story. What was the story that? See, I'm from California, so XPW was trying to be ECW. I know that for sure, and they were trying their hardest. So they decided to buy tickets. If you guys don't know, it's Heatwave 2000. There's an indie company called XPW, Extreme Pro Wrestling, or something like that, and they basically bought a bunch of tickets to the front row of ECW's Heatwave 2000's debut in L.A., and so they decided to get involved in a matchup. Or, you know, I'll let you start tell the rest of that story because I was actually watching.
The initial thing of that was the XPW guys, and, like, some of these guys are, like, dead today or not around or whatever, so I might mess some of these up. I'm not sure, but I just remember the XPW guy, it was like a porn director guy or something, Rob Black or something, I think
yeah,
his
Rob,
name was.
Yeah, Rob Black.
He used to come around to the ECW shows and hung around. And I remember, like, some of the crazier ECW wrestlers used to hang around with him and party and all that stuff. And, like, there was a falling out somehow. So, like, Rob Black went to California back there and decided to do what I guess everybody does eventually, open up his own wrestling company. So he called himself Extreme Pro Wrestling, XPW, instead of ECW. So it went out, whatever. So they're in California.
Because Extreme is spelled with an E, not an X, right?
Yeah,
ahead,
it was absurd. So he goes out there, he's doing his own thing, and, you know, they had ECW was trying to get out to California for years to expand out there. So they finally get the big pay-per-view set, and I give them credit. I don't know how they pulled this off, but XPW guys, somehow they bought, like, 10 or 15 front-row tickets. So, like, these limousines are outside before the show and this and that, and the whole XPW guys. All I remember is, like, the show is starting, and there's a whole bunch of guys in the front row with XPW shirts on. You know, some of them had builds, and you could tell they were gimmicks. I don't know who any of these guys were, but they were all, like, gimmicks and shit. You could tell they were in wrestling. So, like, next thing you know, we identify them. Paul sees them, Tommy sees them, all that. So Atlas Security goes down and makes them take the XPW shirts off on and put ECW and all that stuff on. So, that, you know, they already know. So, like, we already know they're in the front row, and there's more of them walking around the building and whatnot. So we just was like, let's just put it this way. It didn't take much to ignite the ECW locker room to begin with. I mean, you already had an entire group of misfits and miscreants and legitimate fighters and tough guys and just maniacs and brawlers and guys that were going to bleed for ECW because we all believed in it. We loved it. It was our home. And we were led by Paul, who there was no way he was going to get punked out on his own deal. So the entire pay-per-view goes on. No big deal. There's no nothing. Everybody has one eye on them, though. And then somehow during Dreamer versus PJ, I don't know to this day if, like, one of them took a swipe at Francine or something, whatever. Next thing I know, there's a big melee at ringside, and, like, the powder keg gets lit. So the XPW guys are swinging at them, and Atlas Security runs over. Next thing you know, a bunch of the guys go running out of the back, go running down the ringside, start hitting them. The fracas, it's on tape. It's on the pay-per-view itself. So the fracas gets broken up. They get ejected from the building. Next thing I know, a bunch of the guys are coming through the back, and I just see, like, Paul Heyman takes the headset off, turns his hat around, and leads a march outside to literally confront the XPW guys. So all I'm going to say at this point is, because this is rehashing 20-year-old stuff, when the ECW guys got outside, it was literally like the Old West. The XPW guys are on one side of the street. The ECW guys are on the other side of the street. Next thing you know, somebody blinked. I don't know who threw the first punch or whatever happened. I just know that at the end of the day, all the XPW people were pretty much getting in their cars, holding their wounded and whatnot, and, like, all leaving there, the scene of the crime, while there was a live pay-per-view going on. So there was literally – what shocks me most is that there was never – I mean, obviously nobody knew it was going to go down. But there was never a single ounce of footage Could you imagine that going on today? I mean, you would have 27 different camera angles from cell phones.
Yeah.
But there was never a piece of footage produced from any of that. Like, even, like, I couldn't believe the XPW guys didn't, like, have cameras to film this or that or, like, whatever. There's never been a single piece of footage from the XPW-ECW brawl that's ever been produced, which is,
you know,
so shocking to me.
On that. Yeah.
Seriously,
they
man. Think about
that.
It.
Even if they got beat up, you know, they could have, that could have been used.
Anything. Just to say, hey, this is released in court. We were going to sue this one for hitting us or that or whatever. I mean, it went on for a little while. Just to this day, I couldn't believe, like, they didn't have a camera guy there to capture it, just to capture, like, their invasion of the ECW show or something like that. But the fact that no one filmed it or anything like that, I mean, I talked about this with a bunch of guys a million times. I can't believe nobody filmed it. But it was just another day in the life of ECW, and it's what made ECW a totally different promotion. I mean, the company that wrestles together fights together, and it is what it is, man. I mean, there was literally a melee in the middle of the street in Los Angeles during a live pay-per-view.
and that's not the greatest neighborhood in the world either. That's the funny thing. I remember they left
there
the
were cops there and everything.
there
were cops there and everything. The cops were sitting there watching it, yeah.
Oh, my God, that's awesome. Yeah, I just mean, I always hear the stories. Like, again, the story I've heard is the same as what you just said. And, you know, I have a few friends that wrestled XPW, and they're really cool guys and whatnot. But it's crazy, like you said, no cameras. But like you said, if that happened today, holy crap, that would be all over.
I didn't resent any of them either, Bob. By the way, I didn't resent any of those guys for doing that because they were following their company loyalty. The worst part about the whole thing is that it should have never happened. Like, when XPW bought the shirts to go to the front row and all this kind of stuff, they knew in the back of their head there was only one way that was going to wind up. Now, I don't think they thought there was going to be a fight outside, but they literally came there with the intention of, like, ruining something for ECW. And it didn't make any sense. Like, just work on your own product, promote your own show, have your own thing. But to have a big fight at ringside with talent on the other side of the barricade made no sense. And when they got thrown outside, you know, that was what it was going to escalate to. And it shouldn't have ever happened, man. It was unfortunate. And it was just a weird situation, but I hated it. I hated that it happened. But, you know, it was just weird, man. It should have never happened.
Well, you know, I was at the show, actually, and I was, like, first or second row. I remember that. Across from that side. And the whole night, they weren't even, like, typical fans, obviously, because they were trying to beat a cool wrestler and try to, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like they're doing what they were told, basically. They went in there and they weren't reacting to nothing. They were sitting on their hands, basically, just trying to be cool. And until, I guess, that moment when somebody must have said something, because the main event, they knew they were going to, it's the last match. That's probably why they waited, so they could see the whole show. And not,
well,
you know,
the fans,
really
too. Don't
show,
be wrong.
You know?
I said the same thing.
Exactly.
I said the same thing to Dreamer. I said to Dreamer, I go, if you notice, they basically sat and watched the whole show because they're fans of the product and they can say what they want, but a lot of wrestlers on that company or on that show, they liked ECW. They liked what we did. They saw the athleticism we were doing, the cool moves, the guys who they were fans of. They were fans. I mean, they were brought there to defend their company and do whatever, but none of those guys are sitting there like, oh, screw these pieces of shit or this or that or whatever. Like, they wanted to see the show too. So, I mean, it just sucks that it happened afterwards. Because years later, you know, when I was in UPW, I crossed paths with a bunch of the XPW guys, and they were cool, man. I mean, we talked about that, and they were cool, and they understood it, and they were just guys in the industry who were trying to make a break, and they stood behind something that they felt was right, but it just should have never got to that point.
So in 2001, ECW ends up closing down. I believe it was Guilty's Charge, or I forgot the last pay-per-view. Was Guilty of Charge, I believe, is 2001. So the next, like I said, I seen you in Heat Wave 2000 in LA. And then the next time I started seeing you was, speaking of what you just said, is Ultimate Pro Wrestling. I started seeing you there. And at that time, you were in the best shape of your life, if I remember right. At least back then, you were like, you were wrestling without a shirt. You were, and then you were teaming up with Kazarian, Frankie Kazarian. You guys were called Evolution. You had Ludi Lane, I think, was your manager. And, can you tell me about your experiences in Ultimate Pro Wrestling? Because that was they brought out a lot of people. I mean, they create what do you call it? They created a lot of stars that end up going to OVW.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm going to touch on OVW and whatnot in a minute because I don't know if a lot of people know, but I believe your debut at OVW when you got your developmental, I believe your debut, you beat John Cena for the OVW Heavyweight Championship, correct? Something like that?
I did, for sure. And I think what we'll do with that, Billy, we'll save that for my return for the show because I got about another 5 minutes left. I have to finish up something for tomorrow morning. But let me finish up with UPW, and then we'll rebook a second visit. But with UPW, I will tell you this. If it wasn't for UPW and Rick Bassman and the way I was treated out there, I absolutely would have quit professional wrestling. ECW had closed. I was traveling around the world. I was getting booked everywhere. I was having a good time. But I had no idea what the longevity was going to be. And, WCW had closed. I had some feelers from the WWE. I didn't know what was going to happen. But long story short, Rick Bassman reached out to me. And he said, "Hey, I'm Rick Bassman from UPW, this whole deal." He goes, "We have a wrestler out here named Aaron Aguilera, Hardcore Kid. He's in a tag team here with a kid named Justin Sane." He goes, "Justin doesn't want to wrestle anymore, but we have to keep Aaron in a tag team." And I said, "Okay, well, I'm really flattered. Why are you calling me?" He goes, "Well, we have to keep Aaron in a tag team. He's under developmental deal. WWE wants to see him in a tag team." So I asked Aaron, "If there's one wrestler in the world that I could bring in here to team with you, Aaron, so you can be showcased to WWE, who would it be?" And Aaron Aguilera said, Nova. He's a huge fan of yours, and he wants you to be his teammate." And I'm like, "Huh?" And I knew Rick Bassman because of the history of the business, discovering the Ultimate Warrior, Sting, and all that. I was flattered. I'm like, UPW was picking up buzz. I had some friends out there like Mike Bell and Smelly and all them guys. I was like, "All right, cool." So I start going out to UPW, and it was an oasis, man. John Heidenreich, Nathan Jones, Horseshoe, all these guys are out there. Frankie Kazarian, obviously, because I met him on Killer Kowalski's, and we hit it off right away. So, and again, long story short, I go out there. They could not have treated me any better. I met Sean O'Hare out there and Mark Jindrak and Chavo was out there. So many other guys. UPW was a hotbed for action. Everybody was coming through. The Galaxy shows were fantastic. Every single month I flew to California. I did the shows out there. After the first couple team with Aaron Aguilera, there was just a mesh difference there. Aaron was a bigger dude, hardcore, kind of like that. And then like somehow me and Frankie got to talking one day, and we were like working out in the ring before the show. And back then, if you looked at me and Frankie side by side, you're like, "Holy shit, this is not only are these guys a spitting image, or they work together the same, they look the same." I thought at that time when we were Evolution that we were one of the most marketable tag teams in the world. And we did some dark matches.
I totally agree.
And, hell yeah, man. I mean, we were good too. And we did a couple WB dark matches. They didn't hire us, which nobody ever gave me a reason why. It doesn't make any sense because I felt we could have made money with Christian and Edge, with the Hardy Boys, or any of those guys. But it is what it is. But my time in UPW was some of the best times of my life. I love Rick Bassman. We all just connected about a month ago. Rick organized a big conference call during this crisis, and Sylvester was on the call, and Tom Howard, and Rick, and Aaron Baker, and a whole bunch of guys. We're going to try to do that more often just to keep in touch with everybody, but Rick is a true survivor. He had a great thing for a lot of years there. The Ballards were on the call, but it was awesome, man. I mean, going to California once a month to be treated like a pro, to be showcased in those matches, and just it was something about it, man. I loved UPW. I loved my time there, and it was fantastic. If it wasn't for UPW, I would not have stayed in the wrestling business.
You know what? Same with me, actually. I mean, I wasn't like in it like you were. I just started out, and Ultimate Pro Wrestling kind of gave me – I trained with Jesse and like I said, and Bill, and Ultimate Pro Wrestling was the first kind of like – really big live shows I ever watched, you know, besides watching WWE and whatnot. And I was like, wow, this is awesome, man. And Jim Ross is watching every show.
Yeah.
And so with Ultimate Pro Wrestling, I always thought that like you guys and the Ballards should have been totally signed. I mean, you guys were so innovative and creative when it comes to tag team wrestling, which is what I end up being involved in pretty much my whole career. So I loved watching you guys' matches. Frankie Kazarian is legitimately the future of pro wrestling back then and even now. And then you were so innovative back then, and even now I'm sure you are as well. So since we need to wrap things up in a couple minutes, We will do a part two with Simon Dean, a.k.a.
Sure.
Nova, a.k.a.
Absolutely.
Mike Boosty. But one before I let you go real quick, we have a segment. I think a couple-minute segment, if that's okay. It's called Rib for Your Pleasure. It's basically the greatest ribs that's ever been pulled on you or you pulled on somebody. And basically it sounds a little like
rib
this.
Rib for Your Pleasure.
That's my professional sound bites, you know what I mean?
Okay.
So to the people listening at home or even on their phones or whatnot, I love this segment because it kind of, you know how it is, what ribs are. If you guys don't know what a rib is, it's basically like a prank or a joke. Do you have anything you can maybe say or talk about?
I for sure, dude. See, all my ribs were always harmless. They never hurt anybody. I was well known back in the day, especially in ECW with the gang back there. I was you can ask Al Snow or Dreamer, a bunch of these guys, man. I was nefarious for my ribs. They always were a lot of fun. They lightened up the mood and we had a good time. I'll give you one that we did on Dreamer. Dreamer and me and my brother Donnie, we went back and forth with ribs a lot. I mean, there were so many that we did. Having 1-800 dial a mattress, drop mattresses to Tommy's house. Me sending a pool company to his house to dig a pool in his backyard. Tommy having the Jerry Springer Show call our house. I mean, just one thing after another. So we set up this one rib, and it was the timing of the rib that went off the way that there's no way on earth we could have planned this any better. It was dark that it happened this way, but it couldn't have worked any better, and he still laughs about it to this day. So here's what happened. Tommy Dreamer's grandfather passes away, and it's a terrible day at the Dreamer house. He's in his house. He's sad. It's after the funeral. It's the day of the funeral. That night, they're at the house. Tommy's upstairs, and he's sad, and the mom is, the family members are there and whatnot. There's a knock at Tommy's front door. And they, mother, aunt, hello, how you doing? Oh, I'm sister so-and-so and sister so-and-so, and we're here for you in your time of need, and we just really want to speak to Tommy in this time, and et cetera, et cetera. So Dreamer's mom is like, all right, well, these must be two fans, or they heard about Tommy's grandfather and whatnot, so they're sisters, and they want to come here and talk to Tommy. So she's like, Tommy, come here, come on down, sister so-, because Dreamer's living in his house still with his mom and dad at this point. Sister so-and-so is here, and Dreamer comes downstairs. They go in the kitchen. These two, like, professionally dressed women are there, and they got books in their hands and stuff, and they pull Dreamer in the kitchen, and they start talking to him. Tommy, we're here for you in your time of need and this crisis, and they're going on and on, but they're never mentioning about the grandfather being deceased or anything. So Dreamer's like, he's saying, so this is odd. So it turns out that these are two women, because they tell him, Tommy, this is a time for you to give yourself to Jesus Christ during this time. You can, come over to the Church of Jesus Christ, Latter-day Saints, the whole deal. Well, it turns out that these two women were from the Church of Jesus Christ, Latter-day Saints, and they were in the house trying to talk to Tommy about becoming a Mormon, that about 2 months earlier, me and my brother had sent in the paperwork that we found in like one of the newspapers and put all Dreamer's information in it to set up an appointment for the Mormons to come to his house to literally like convert him to Mormonism. Well, it just so happened that the day that it unfolded was the day of Dreamer's godfather's death.
Oh my God.
His grandfather's the day of his funeral. So here's the Mormons in his house trying to convert him. And Dreamer starts piecing things together in his head. Well, then Dreamer's mother comes in the kitchen, and they're devout Catholics and Christianity the whole bit. She starts, like, flipping out and melting down. Tommy, you're turning your back on Christianity. Don't do this. Don't do this. And, like, cutting a promo on Dreamer in his own kitchen because she thinks that he's switching religions. And then when this is going on, he's realizing, like, holy shit, I know what happened. So, like, he has to apologize to the nun. Thank you for coming out. He explains to Grandpa dying the whole bit. And then once he ushers him out of the house, then he has to try to explain to his mother what happened, that it was a big joke that was played, this whole deal. But his mother, as any other human being would, can't rationalize that there's these two devils out there that would ever play this joke on somebody, because she didn't get – like, they're thinking we must have done this earlier in the day. Like, she's not realizing we did this months ago, but it just all cosmically worked out that way. Because I remember being at the ECW show a couple days later, and, like, Francine comes over, and even Paul Lee was like, brother, I can't believe you guys. I'm like, guys, this is the way it all worked out. What do you want me to tell you? I mean, they all thought it was hilarious and it was awesome. And if you ever run across Dreamer, ask him about it. But,
yeah.
I mean, I had dozens of those, man. I mean, I got Al. I'll leave you with this for the next time we do this. I'll tell you about the one we did to Al Snow that accumulated with the Lima police and the zookeepers and everybody showing up at Al's house because there were reports of a boa and a python in Al's basement named Damien. And the 6 o'clock news showed up to try to capture the recovery of the python out of Al's basement. So I'll
give
you guys that one.
Yeah. So we'll have you back. I'll set it up, next couple of days. We'll figure out the next day. Cause I know people are going to want to hear all this stuff. All the fans and anybody listening, we haven't even touched on his Simon Dean character. We haven't even touched on the fact that he was helping run OVW, the developmental, back in the day. There's so much that we could talk about because this gentleman that we're listening to has been doing this for almost 30 years. And that's the reason why he has so much to offer. So I hope people listen to this and realize this is what professional wrestling is all about. So before I leave you, I do want to say one last thing. I meant to do it earlier before I even started. I definitely want to say positive vibes to the WWE wrestlers and staff that got released yesterday. I know that was tough on everybody, and they'll kick through it. And there's going to be more stuff. I know it's a real tough time. And also, rest in peace, man. Rest in peace to the greatest ring announcer of all time, Howard Finkel, passed away today. So
I agree.
To get that out there.
I should have said that in the beginning. My heart goes out to all the people who lost their lifelong dream yesterday. We can spend a whole show talking about that. But more importantly, the business yesterday, today, the business lost a legend, a friend, a mentor, a teacher in Howard Finkel. I'm going to put him in the same category as Roddy Piper, Macho Man, Dusty, all the Luthez, all the legends who have passed before them. Howard Finkel absolutely goes in that same category with them. He's the voice of a generation. Every single time we lose somebody like that, we lose a piece of what this was, and it reminds us of what it can never become again. And it sucks because I was friends with Howard. I worked with Howard behind the scenes, and I talked to him several years back. And at 69 years old, we've lost a living piece of history in a sport that we all love, and it sucks.
No, yeah, and I mean, it's greatest of all time, and he's, yeah, it's hard to even like put words into it, just because he's just such an iconic figure of WWF. I mean, exactly.
Yep.
When you person you see, WrestleMania 1, first person you see. Anyway, we can go on, like I said, for a long time. Legend in the business, yourself a legend, and we want to thank you for coming on the show. One last thing for everybody at home. If you want to reach Nova online, you're going to have to ask somebody else because he'll get a hold of you.
It's just Mike Bucci. That's it. Just Mike Bucci on Facebook.
Yeah.
I don't have Twitter. I don't have Instagram, Snapchat, none of that stuff. I just got Facebook under Mike Bucci, and that's it. So.
Yep, and we're the biggest little show on radio. We also have Vendetta Pro Radio. We have Marty Elias, former WWE referee, will be on the show next week. And obviously,
cool.
We have Sin Bodhi coming in. We also have TJ Perkins.
Nice.
So, Simon, or I like calling you Nova. Nova, thanks for being on, man.
Oh,
I haven't talked to you in so many years. We'll set something else. Fans, look forward to part
all
two
right,
because you don't want to miss it. Thanks. I'll talk to you soon, man. Take care.
All right, man. I'll holler at you, brother. Later. Bye-bye.
For sure. Bye. So, ladies and gentlemen, this is the biggest little show on radio. That is part one with Nova, Simon Dean. We will be back with him. Part two in the next couple weeks, maybe in the next month. Definitely a great show. I learned a lot just by listening to this show. It was almost an hour long, and we still have a lot to talk about. He has done so much in the business, and he's obviously somebody who's very passionate about the business even to this day. So I'm going to leave you with this song. With everything going on in the world today, this song is Party Like Tomorrow's Day in the World, from the band Steel Panther. And thank you for being on. We'll be on Tuesday as well. Vendetta Pro Radio, co-hosted by Bro and Bo Cooper. We have our guest is going to be Little Hank Dalton, one of our Micromania wrestlers and also one of the top midget wrestlers in the world today. And then the following week, that's April 21st, April 28th, we have one of the top up-and-coming wrestlers in the California scene. His name is the Midnight Delight, Richie Slade. Then we also have, like I was saying, April. At the end of April, we do have Marty Elias, the last Thursday. I'm sorry, I can't remember what date, but I'll have it set up. But, yeah, TJ Perkins, we got Sin Bodhi, we got Marty Elias. Plus, we got a lot of other guests coming up that will be announced next week. So thank you for being on, listening, and I hope you guys enjoyed Simon Dean, a.k.a. Hollywood Nova, a.k.a. Supernova. I'll talk to you guys next week. I hope everybody is doing good out there. We'll be back to running shows and performing for all of you guys really soon. Have a good night, and stay safe.